Dear listeners, hello and welcome to this, the 238th edition of Sudbury's News Talk magazine. I trust we find you well. I'm Michelle Mandry, your presenter for this month's magazine. Before we start, I will just let you know that Ruth Salisbury Higgs has stepped down as Sudbury News Talk magazine presenter and contributor. Ruth's new career as a celebrant, officiating at wedding and naming ceremonies, as well as other important occasions, has really taken off. And as we know, there aren't enough hours in the day for all the things we'd like to do. Ruth has given a great deal of thought and time to her work with the magazine. Her readings and presenting were always given with great verve and wit, assets which I'm quite sure she will bring to each of the occasions she celebrates. I'd like to thank Ruth on behalf of contributors and listeners and wish her the very best. Back to today, and we have just marked Remembrance Day, a day which has become etched into our annual cycle as firmly as Midsummer and Christmas. I'm not certain, but this may be the reason I chose nostalgia as the topic for this edition, not forgetting that November also serves as our Christmas edition. So without further ado, Margaret King is here to introduce us to today's theme.
Nostalgia. The dictionary definition of the abstract noun, nostalgia, pans out as something like this: a sentimental longing or wishful affection for a period in the past, or a feeling of sadness mixed with pleasure and affection when you think of happy times in the past. I guess those definitions sum it up fairly well. Nostalgia and past times, often long past, have to be good bedfellows. As we look back upon our lives, we inevitably pinpoint a number of unforgettable occurrences: marriages, children's births, achievements, holidays, deaths, many intensely happy, others intensely sad, but all significantly etched forever in our memories. They are often recalled nostalgically, but many other happenings we recall are quite idiosyncratic, unplanned, and triggered off when least expected. Literature and popular culture both abound with references of nostalgia. Frank Sinatra sang of the days of wine and roses, whilst T.S. Eliot, during his ponderings about time, evoked these longings: footfalls echo in the memory, down the path which we did not take, towards the door we never opened, into the rose garden. Both these quotes feature roses. What is it about roses? Is it their profusion or aroma that compel lyricists and poets to use roses to evoke nostalgia? I guess that it's both, along with the rest of our senses, which so often send us back to past memories. So, let's follow those footfalls and see where they lead. One is only to mention the 60s and nostalgia kicks in. A picture of girls in the King's Road and thoughts go immediately to Swinging London, The Beatles, Mary Quant, miniskirts, Carnaby Street, The Kinks and, a bit later, Flower Power. I could go on and on. It was certainly an era of great change, propelled by new and distinctly different music, theatre and fashion. Whenever I hear the Love and Spoonful belting out Summer in the City, it's 1966 again, and I'm walking down a street in a very hot Brighton. The power of all kinds of music never fails but to be nostalgic, be it classical, jazz, rock. For me, it has to be Elgar's Nimrod, our wedding hymn, Come Down, O Love Divine, and always Bohemian Rhapsody and These Are the Days of Our Lives, later memories. And the New Wave Theatre, pioneered by Look Back in Anger in 1956, the 60s saw plays which became known as kitchen sink dramas. I recall my first visit to a West End theatre and seeing a very young Albert Finney in Billy Lyre. I've still got the programme. Books and films followed, Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, Room at the Top, A Taste of Honey, This Sporting Life, and of course Peter O'Toole in Lawrence of Arabia. Here I have instant memories of a matinee showing in a Crawley cinema, unfortunately full of primary school aged children who were clearly bored and rather over noisy. Throughout most of the 60s I was in London, and whilst it was great to see, hear and be part of new fresh ideas, on reflection, do we romanticise our memories? Student days, schools, colleges and universities likewise bring on nostalgic memories. Here again, I think that we forget the day-to-day mundanity and focus on the sudden, quaint and often humorous experiences we remember. Back to the 60s again. Food cooking. Our senses of taste and smell evoke much nostalgic longing. Mid-60s, and as students, we stayed overnight in a very simple Greek house on the island of Aegina. It was, in those days, an idyllic place, much as it had been for centuries. Tourist development only came later. The next morning, we found a street vendor cooking something which looked and smelt delicious. Barbecued meat, vegetables and herbs were wrapped in what we now know is pita bread. For a long time, I recalled this snack, and it wasn't until many, many years later, whilst flicking through a holiday cookery book, that I discovered it was called souvlaki. Of course, this was well before the internet. Believe it or not, my airing cupboard holds a treasure chest of memories. I find the thick black jumper there, which I knitted in 1963 to keep warm in what was Britain's second worst winter since records began. Close beside it is the now rather moth-eaten London College scarf. Both these items of clothing were in constant use during that long winter, when, for the first and only time in my life, we jumped up and down on the deeply frozen lake in the college grounds. Very cold, but nostalgic memories. Dig deeper in the airing cupboard, and Christmas memories are brought to the surface. A box containing girl and school friend annuals given to me as presents from a favourite aunt. Another aunt, I had six at that time, sent me exciting Christmas parcels full of unusual gifts, quirky games, trick spoons, funny puzzles, and for one Easter, a decorated sugar egg enclosing a 3D peep show. I've still got the box. This aunt lived in Brighton, and I figured out that it was an infinitely superior place to live than Glemsford. Most of us recall those early Christmases. Not much money about, for sure. The feast of an annual chicken and gammon, the stuffed pillowcase at the bottom of the bed, which I think contained even then the traditional nuts and oranges in the bottom. The front parlour being opened and a fire lit. A real tree erected. Paper chains and crepe paper decorations hung all over the ceiling, supplemented by some holly sprigs. Card and board games. No TV. My mother spending every Christmas Eve making, from scratch, puff pastry for a multitude of sausage rolls. Many were consumed before the trip to the midnight service. Incidentally, they were delicious. I can almost taste them now. I also wish that, like Dylan Thomas in his conversation about Christmas in Wales to a small boy, I too could pretend that every Christmas was white and that the snow fell gently on demand. Sadly, this was not so. And as we grow older, Christmas nostalgia changes. Old families go, new young families, children, grandchildren, friends emerge. Presents, games, toys, entertainment, all memorable but different. In conclusion, whilst following those footfalls from the past, I have tried to share with you just a small sample of experiences which indulge nostalgic memories for me. Undoubtedly, there are many more, as nostalgia is remarkably unpredictable.
Thank you, Margaret King. What a lot you managed to fit into a few short, evocative minutes. I'm in awe of your fantastic airing cupboard. What a trove of memories and mementos. But the description of your mother making puff pastry took me back to my own childhood. Our next piece is from a new contributor, John King, and I'm sure you will enjoy John's nostalgic excursions as much as I did. John.
Thank you. On a still warm late August evening, just about twilight, I'm at peaceful repose on a seat in the garden, just enjoying the last warm comfort of the day. Nothing on the road. In the distance to the right, I believe I hear a slight throb. This gradually resolves into the sound of a motorcycle engine. It's still some way off, and as the sound travels well in such conditions, almost pure in tone. Gradually, the throb becomes more and more audible, until it is almost here. Then, as it passes, the sound changes owing to the Doppler effect, and the volume diminishes as the motorbike travels into the distance. It takes what seems many seconds before the sound fades to being no longer audible. This type of event, which I have experienced many times, never ceases to jog me into considering the passing of time and onto nostalgic feelings. Throughout most of our lives, we do not consider the time passing. We just get on with life. But then, at times, we may feel a wash of nostalgic emotion, and then time past hits us like a ton of bricks. We may, as they say, have a moment where we disappear into a cloud of mixed emotions. To give an example of some of my nostalgia, I go to the high street of the early 60s, prior to the proliferation of supermarkets. So smaller towns were not really affected by them. And of course, internet shopping did not exist. So most households would shop two or three times a week, going up to town to buy meat, fish, groceries, and then pop into the nearest general store for any missing items, or borrow from the neighbour, always assuming, of course, you got on with the neighbour. Most towns had an array of shops, so you could choose your grocer, baker, butcher, fishmonger, or greengrocer. Almost all villages had a general store, so off you go with your shopping bags and baskets from shop to shop, the weight to carry getting more and more of a burden as you went. Whilst you shop for food, you would pass other shops like furniture, china, books, sweet shops. Something might catch your eye, so you might buy, or more likely dream. Yes, it was not always convenient, but it had its held communities together in a way that has gone forever, and there was not the ghastly traffic of today. I remember actually leaving prams outside the shops. The late 50s and 60s brought in the coffee bars. Each had its own character and clientele. Some were quite dark inside, and it took some time to become more acclimatised to the light level. Others were quite bright, but with intimate spaces. The coffee, then known as frothy coffee, was 9D, less than 4P. It was made using Italian espresso machines and was always served in wide-mouthed glass cups with saucers and, of course, brown crystal sugar. As the coffee was much cheaper than today's high-priced coffee, they became favourite places for young people to meet. In Sudbury, I remember the Bambi at the top of North Street, the Simba on the corner of North Street and Gainsborough Road, actually, almost facing down Melford Road. the Bongo in Station Road and the Zante Bar in Gainsborough Street. And on the Market Hill, it was Took's Coffee and Cakes. I also recall for a short time one called the Blue Boy at the bottom of Market Hill, which I failed to visit, probably because, along with many of my friends, we were doing national service at that time. Of all the establishments, had tales to tell, some good, some not so good. We all had our favourites. I used the Bambi for playing poker dice, east of Bluff in the semi-light, and the Zante Bar was conversations on a higher plane. I look back upon them with great fondness. Lastly, I would delve into the world of almost instant nostalgia, but one that lasts for years. I talk of the aftermath of a highly treasured event, like a big birthday party, a graduation, or in this instance, a wedding. I'm thinking of several past weddings. The advance notice, the planning, the anticipation, and the event itself. Then it's all over. The guests have gone. The babble has faded to silence. There is just the tables and chairs waiting to clean up. And most emotional of all, the bits of decoration now slightly worn, the rubbish on the floor, and the ballroom or two, and a balloon or two skits across the floor when the door lets the light draft in. It's over. That massive point in two people's lives took just a few hours or last a lifetime. I often think of many things that I never asked Mum and Dad. Do you? Well, if any younger people listen to this and their parents are still alive, I say to you all, ask them questions now. Do it. Now, in the living years, as Mike the mechanic sang. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John King. Your description of the household shopping rounds reminds me of Wicker Baskets, Celia Johnson and black and white films. I particularly enjoyed your account of the various coffee bars as economical and fun places to meet. What memories. I do hope you'll write for us again. Next up, we have the quiz. Thinking caps on, and apologies if you've heard this one before, but A Winter's Tale, number one, A Winter's Tale was a top 10 hit for which British pop star in 1982? Number two, what is the main ingredient of marzipan? Number three, the Christmas tree that brightens up Trafalgar Square each year is gifted to the British people by which country? Number four, who created the fictional butler Jeeves? Number five, in which pantomime would you expect to see Widow Twankey? Number six, what is a coracle? Number seven, which county lies between Norfolk and Essex? Number eight, what was the name of Long John Silver's parrot? Number nine, which city is sometimes known as Auld Reekie? And number 10, NORAD, the North American Aero Defence Command, tracks what every winter and has done since 1955? Well, I'll be back later with the answers. Richard Fawcett has a pertinent question now, and I have a feeling we all know the answer.
People, don't you miss them? Salvaged in 1901 from a vessel wrecked off the Greek island of Antikythera in the 1st century BC, the so-called Antikythera mechanism possesses a complex system displaying the positions of the sun and the moon in the zodiac. According to Britannica, it remained unmatched in astronomical and calendrical terms until the medieval cathedral clocks a millennium later. It would be a further millennium, according to my mother, until my seafaring uncle, turned ship's pilot, found himself aboard a vessel equipped with every electronic navigation system of the modern era, all of which failed simultaneously. My uncle was the single soul aboard capable of navigating using only pre-electronic era methods. Following my drift? Yes. The wheel turns and things come back into fashion. But some things don't, and I'm suggesting we can often be too keen to discard things. But why? Folks in the past could know as much and maybe more than we do. Do we really know how they built the pyramids or Stonehenge? Did they all believe the earth was flat? Did Columbus really believe in 1492 the earth was flat and he'd fall off the edge? Are things really better or worse because they're new or old? I recall a recent headline. As IT becomes more sophisticated, our data is more at risk. But it wasn't meant to be so. Now that would not be a good advert for, say, the early railways. As our trains become more sophisticated, our lives are more at risk. On two recent occasions, 12 months apart, I phoned for information about a pension rather than going online because I could not fathom the online system. I was twice told, 12 months apart, that the new system has teething problems. It had nonetheless been approved for use. Shades of the post office scandal, perhaps? During the pandemic period, I noticed how often young people at school and at college were reported to be pleading for face-to-face teaching rather than online classes. The internet generation? Rejecting the internet? I suggest they were rather rejecting the internet in that particular context and would surely continue to use it in other contexts. We know that human beings are fallible, therefore what we make is fallible. Therefore humans can and will make decisions based on considerations of face-saving, cost-cutting, fashionableness, and my particular bugbear, convenience. Convenience. Isn't that the same as laziness? So, how about a campaign to bring back people before we fill our supermarkets with technology that often seems not to work, and before we sideline the humble and fallible human being who can valuably serve us to remind us of our fallibility? Let's think again. Machines, yes, of course, but in their place.
Thank you, and well said, Richard Fawcett. It's not that I'm a Luddite, but I too prefer dealing with a human to a machine most of the time. I have also experienced the kind of technology fail your uncle did. Luckily, like your uncle, a more experienced colleague was on hand to save the day. And now we come to Jackie McSweeney's item. And if this doesn't warm the cockles, nothing will. Jackie.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. This is my third chat to you all. And as the old saying goes, everything that comes in threes is perfect. A tall order. So here's my attempt. I cast my memory back to secondary school, for me, in the 1970s, where we first experienced teenage angst of emotions, of love, hate, joy and pain, all expressed to and with our best friends. I was in a group of five girls and two boys. We were quite a mixed bag, but Kathy was my bestie. We lived fairly close to each other, and I would frequently hang around her house with her and her family, who treated me as their fourth child. Jack, her dad from Newcastle, a booming voice and raucous laugh with a genuine Cheshire Cat grin across his wide open face. Jack was a factory worker, but his passion was judo, and he travelled the world teaching kids, including myself, I've got the injuries, this great martial art. Jack was balanced by Jean, Kathy's mum. Quiet, calming and unassuming, but with a brain as sharp as a tack. I got on really well with her two-year older brother David and her two-year younger sister Christine. Their home gave me sanctuary from the torrid teenage rebellious years I was going through in my own home. After we left school, Kathy and I continued to see a lot of each other, discovering young men, alcohol and live music and a few other things. Many of the old haunts have all since been demolished or refashioned into something unrecognisable. The Cone Lodge, the Headgate, the Cups, the Ship. But we love going to see live bands at the university under the podium. A few pints in the student union bar, then dance to the music and get deafened by the sounds of some of the best at the time. Top of the list was a singer-songwriter called John Martin. We were both smitten with his voice, his lyrics and the melodic sounds. We saw him a few times and the night when Phil Collins joined him on stage was a highlight. Kathy's older brother David was a huge fan and we often ran into him with his mates out enjoying our youth. I had a bit of a crush on David, an immense enchanting smile inherited from his dad with a fantastic sense of humour, a very bright and charming, sensible young man. As time wore on, Kathy and I began to drift. In 1980, I'd met my lifelong partner, Andy, and focused on my career. Kathy eventually settled on her husband, after a few errors, and got busy raising her three sons. I'd always sent Kathy birthday and Christmas cards, but finally lost touch over 30 years ago. The singer, John Martin, died in January 2009, aged 60. The alcohol and drugs had taken their toll. The memories of listening to his LPs round at Kathy's house flooded back, and I still listen to his music. He's a constant in my eclectic tastes. In 1992, Andy and I had moved to Sudbury and settled. I still have many ties in my old hometown of Colchester. It was one evening in 2022, I saw Colchester Arts Centre advertising a group called the John Martin Project, playing in January 23. I had to go. I hadn't been there for years. I asked around a few friends if they wanted to join me, but I think John was an obscure artist, so I went on my own. The Colchester Arts Centre is a lovely venue, and after I bought a drink, I made my way to an empty seat in the second row, as I didn't want to miss a note. The crowd was settling down when I suddenly heard a booming voice across the centre in a broad Newcastle accent. "Why aye, Jackie McSweeney!" I turned round and there, standing in a row, three rows behind me were Kathy, her sister, Chris and Jack and Jean. Jack called me again, waving. They all waved, their mouths wide open in surprise. My eyebrows nearly lifted off my head. "I don't believe it!" Then the John Martin Project started their set. The familiar music washed over us with waves of emotion, the memories flooding back as the best of John's songs ran out in melodic harmonies. Oh, the deep bass sounds vibrating through me and sending goosebumps and a warm feeling of a comfort blanket being wrapped around me. I rushed to my second favourite family in the interval, where we all hugged and someone kindly let me have their seat so we could all sit together. Jack told me they all had to come to watch their son David's favourite tribute to John Martin, as David had died just a few months earlier and John had been played at David's funeral. I was stunned, winded almost, the tears uncontrollably leaking out of my eyes. We all hugged again. Oh, then the joy and happiness kicked in and at finding each other as the music recommenced. A fabulous night. And we swapped details as we walked back to the car park. We weren't going to let each other go again. Needless to say, Kathy and I have met many, many times since. That original bond's stronger than ever. I've also visited Jack and Jean at home, the same home from all those years ago, now filled with memories of their lives together and their loving family. Jack gave me some of his prized homemade jam. I gave him some cheeky laughs. Kath boys are now grown, starting families of their own. For us, we kind of picked up from where we left off. Maybe not the trips to the pubs, which are now replaced with walks by the sea or through a wood and grabbing a bite to eat. The love of music continues though, and we do like to go and see some bands and have a bit of a jig about to some good sounds. Mostly, we love chatting, laughing and reminiscing, filling in each other in all those lost years. None of that would have been possible without John Martin. So thank you, John, for being there at the beginning, providing constant tuneful comfort throughout my life, but most importantly, allowing Kathy and me to find each other again.
Thank you, Jackie McSweeney, for such a moving story. It beautifully illustrates the power music has to bring people together and reunite them after absence, along with a large dose of coincidence. Now, Ken Watkins is here to read Toby Jacobs' contribution.
In 1981, the pop group The Buggles, fronted by legendary record producer Trevor Horn, released a song called Video Killed the Radio Star. This was the era of MTV, or music television, where being seen was just as, if not more important than, being heard. The song alludes to the premise that the days of listening to radio were over, and that music could only be enjoyed when accompanied by a visual promo or video. This was a bold statement, considering that the radio, prior to television, was the centrepiece to most people's homes. Families would gather round a set to listen to a particular show, and the DJs, or disc jockeys, became stars in their own right. In this piece, I would like to reminisce about some of the radio stations that I've enjoyed over the years, and to prove that radio is still as important today as it always was, whatever the Buggles said. This particular day in the late 90s was no different to any other. However, it would prove to be the start of a relationship that would go on for nearly 15 years. As I came into the kitchen from doing some shopping, I did what I could always do and put the radio on. I still don't know how it came to be on BBC Radio London, as it wasn't really a station that I ever listened to. The topic up for discussion was why was there a coffin up a tree on Barnes Common? I remember thinking to myself that this seemed rather odd, but also quite interesting. It turns out that I was listening to the Robert Elms show, and this particular segment was called Notes and Queries. Listeners would phone up with their unusual questions about London, and Robert would choose one or two to try to solve, courtesy of the audience. I have to tell you at this point, I can't remember why there was a coffin up a tree on Barnes Common. As I listened further, I really felt that I'd stumbled upon something rather splendid. Robert Elms is a journalist and broadcaster from Burnt Oak in North London. His ancestors hailed from Nottingdale in West London, hence why he supports Queen's Park Rangers. A first for the family, he attended the prestigious London School of Economics. Swept along by the emergence of punk, Robert soon found the nightclubs of Soho a regular haunt. Subsequently, he is an authority on the many youth tribes that came out of London in the 70s and 80s. See him on YouTube introducing a very youthful Spandau Ballet at one of their early gigs. After a spell as a fashion journalist and travel writer, he joined Radio London in 1994, and his show has been going strong ever since. As well as Notes and Queries, the show featured a slot called Listed Londoner. This is where a famous person would come on and answer 20 questions related to their life in the capital, such as favourite neighbourhood, worst building or best shop. Architecture featured prominently, and this segment was usually hosted by Professor Maxwell Hutchinson. Another part was called Cover to Cover, where listeners were invited to choose between two different versions of the same song. Forfer was where you had to choose the best four songs from a specific artist. There was also a food and drink slot and a musical biography segment hosted by Russell Clark, the rock and roll routemaster. Music featured heavily in the show, and Robert's taste was eclectic, to say the least. He regularly played anything from club reggae to country. Meanwhile, Jason Solomons was guaranteed to recommend the best from the latest cinema releases. Blue Badge guide Diane Bernstein was another regular contributor, and she would take you on a virtual tour around some of the nooks and crannies of old London. Finally, if you'd had a rough week, you could always tune in for Funky Friday. Someone who did became a regular listener, none other than Rod Stewart himself. This was, in part, due to the fact that Robert was a big Faces fan and often played their music. It wasn't unusual to hear, "Hold on, Rod's on the line." I learnt so much from Robert's show and listened almost daily until I moved away in 2015. The show is still going strong, and it can be listened to on BBC Sounds or live on Friday, Saturday and Sunday mornings on Channel 721 on Freeview. Rewind to 1983, and as a fresh-faced teenager of 13 years, I was hooked onto a new type of music coming out of the South Bronx in New York City. We called it electro-funk, but it would later become known as hip-hop. It wasn't easy accessing this type of music. Only certain record shops were selling it, and even then you had to know what to ask for. However, word got around that a pirate radio station called LWR was playing electro, hosted by a very young Tim Westwood. My friends and I would rush home from school to tune in at 4 o'clock. As we searched the dial, I can't describe the joy we felt upon hearing the station beaming out across the airwaves. It wasn't always easy to find, as the frequency would change regularly. Pirate radio stations were constantly moving around, trying to keep one step ahead of the authorities. They were usually located in tower blocks for extra broadcasting height. With the names of our favourite tunes in our heads, we were able to go to one of the specialist shops and sound like we knew what we were doing. "Can I have the Wiki Wiki song by Nucleus?" I said coolly on my next visit. I was in, one of the tribe. As the music eventually splintered into different directions, such as house, rave, and UK garage, the pirate radio stations were still a source of the latest underground trends. The tradition of renegade broadcasting, laid down by the likes of Radio Caroline, is alive and kicking, and coming from a tower block near you. These are just two of my radio memories that I've chosen to relay to you today. I could have mentioned many more, such as Capital Radio, LBC, and Kiss FM. In an era before the internet, radio really was the senior service, and I wholeheartedly hope that it isn't usurped by today's modern technology. That would be a sad day.
Thank you, Ken Watkins and Toby Jacobs, for honouring the endurance of radio and its place in daily life. The kettle and the radio are definitely the two most important items in my house. I enjoyed Toby's description of Robert Elms' radio programme, which I will take as a recommendation, and almost don't need to know why there was a coffin up a tree on Barnes Common. Almost. And now I have very great pleasure in introducing today's guest, Rachel Taylor, manager of Sudbury Library, who is here to share with us some of the things that they do and offer. Rachel.
Hello, my name is Rachel. I work at Sudbury Library. Some of you may know it as the enormous building in the centre of town. It's the other one with the pillars, Town Hall being one, us being the other. Built in 1841 and converted in 1960-something, when Andrew Phillips realised that pulling it down was probably a bad idea, let's put the library there instead. And I, for one, am very grateful because it's provided me with a job and also the opportunity to work alongside the community and do a lot of things that I never thought I'd get the chance to do. So I've been invited here today to talk about some of the things we do in the library, and I've brought a few bits with me, so you may hear some rustling as I get these things out. Obviously, one thing that we do is books, but you may not be aware of the variety of ways that you can access books. So there's the printed media, we have the normal size print, and we also have large print for those who can use that. And I've brought along today a Stephen Fry book. You'll notice a pattern as I keep telling you this. So his autobiography, by Stephen Fry, which is rather lovely. Then I've also brought along some CDs. These are books that are read usually by somebody who is trained, unlike myself, to talk and explain and act their way through these stories. So I have here a Sherlock Holmes. I've picked all these at random. I have a Sherlock Holmes, and coincidentally, I picked this really coincidentally, again, read by Stephen Fry. I've got a Douglas Adams, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Who can forget that wonderful story? Again, a Stephen Fry. Perhaps you're interested in something a little bit more crime, a little bit more violent, a little bit of a thriller. So we have here a Ruth Rendell, The Veiled One. And I'll read you a little tiny bit of this, the blurb. Concealed by a shroud of dirty brown velvet, looking like a heap of rags, the woman's dead body lay between a silver Escort and a dark blue Lancia. In the desolate shopping centre car park, Wexford has been too preoccupied to notice anything out of the ordinary. Only the teenage girl in the red car, driving past him rather too fast. Well, listening to that, you think, what happens next? Perhaps a bit of non-fiction might take your fancy. What about John Humphreys, who is read again by John Humphreys, talking about his life in politics and his life in the media. We do other things at the library too. We have a great emphasis on the community. So we've got interesting things for people who are struggling. So at the moment, we're focusing on the cost of living that's affecting everybody. We're offering nowadays internet connections and mobile phone help for those who are struggling to afford it. We're offering a warm welcome of tea, coffee and little biscuits for those who are struggling to get those things and need somewhere warm to be. We have books on reading for mental health. I'm going through these. We have a fantastic, and I mean fantastic, Seconds of Sound, which is an online collaboration between Suffolk Libraries and a field recordist called Martin Scaife, where he's recorded wildlife and wild sounds. Perhaps you'd like to listen to it sometime. I could go on and explain so many more things. There's ebooks, e-audio books. There's things that you can look up. There's things you can listen to. There's groups you can join. Why not try our Monday group? There's so much more to do in the libraries, but I have to emphasise there's not just Sudbury Library. Perhaps you live near Lavenham or Cornard or Clare. Perhaps you're near Glemsford. All of these are Suffolk libraries. And if you have a card for one, you have a card for all of them. So I do implore you, visit them, use them, because they're there for you.
Thank you very much, Rachel Taylor. I really very much appreciate you coming and being our guest today. I don't think you mentioned that that Suffolk Libraries is actually a charity. It's no longer run by the local council. So please do support it if you can. I know I go in there quite often now, not just for books. One book that Rachel didn't mention, and which has intrigued me just by its title, is Murder by Milk Bottle by Lynn Truss. It's an audiobook, and I think I'm going to have to read it now. So thank you for bringing it in. And now the other moment you've all been waiting for. Here are the answers to the quiz. Number one, A Winter's Tale was a 1982 top 10 hit for David Essex, my fave. Number two, almonds are the main ingredient of marzipan. Number three, Norway sends a Norway spruce to the British people each December as a token of gratitude for their support during World War II when Norway was an occupied country. Number four, P.G. Wodehouse created the fictional butler Jeeves. Jeeves served the hapless Bertie Wooster, of course. Number 5. In Panto, Widow Twankey is Aladdin's mother. So, Aladdin. Number 6. A coracle is a small keelless boat, meaning it has a flat bottom. Usually, they're made of a basketwork frame and propelled by a single paddle at the front of the craft in a figure of eight motion. Number 7. I do hope you got this one. The magnificent county of Suffolk lies between Norfolk and Essex, naturally. It wasn't exactly a trick question, but still. Number 8. Long John Silver's parrot was named Captain Flint. Slapping heads in the recording studio here. Number 9. Edinburgh is sometimes known as Auld Reekie. And number 10, and finally, NORAD has been tracking Santa's progress around the globe on Christmas Eve every winter since 1955. More of which later. Our penultimate item is a rhyme from the pen of Julie Thompson, who gives us the sorry tale of a malfunctioning vehicle and its desperate owner. Julie.
'Twas the night before Christmas, and all was still, apart from rotund red Santa at the top of Angel Hill. He was huffing and a-puffing and making a fuss, trying to squeeze all the presents on a red Chambers bus. His sleigh, it was knackered, kaput, broken down. He'd tried to mend it, no fault could be found. So a night off of work for the 9 reindeer. But how would he transport all of this gear? Then Rudolph suggested the Chambers 753 to deliver the gifts from Bury to Sudbury. At only £2 a journey, with the price cap in place, being chauffeured by a driver with a big smiley face. Santa wasn't popular. He rang the bell for each stop. He had 2,000 presents that he had to drop. The usual journey takes just over an hour, but it was taking too long, even with Santa's superpower. It stopped in Bradfield Combust at the Manger Pub. The locals offered to deliver gifts after they'd had their grub. Then onwards to Lavenham and to the Cock Horse, who loaded up his carriage and delivered there, of course. Into Long Melford, so many pubs to choose. Santa picked the Swan. He had nothing to lose. The regulars, they took on the magnificent task, delivering gifts from the first house to the last. Finally, that red bus pulled up in Sudbury. The bay horse folk were busy decorating their tree. They finished their pints and gave Santa a high five, delivering the last of the presents for him before morning arrived. Santa thanked the driver and the patient passenger folk, alighted the bus and strolled off into the Sudbury smoke, down to the croft where he found the reindeers grazing. Our Christmas deliveries have all been done. Now that is amazing. So from Santa and the reindeers and the News Talk team, we wish you all an amazing Christmas, and please keep on listening.
Thank you, Julie Thompson. What a delightful story and pub crawl with a difference. I can almost hear the grumbling passengers, but what could he do? I very much enjoyed the topical appearance of the Manger Pub too. All really is well that ends well. Which brings me to the final contribution for this edition. No grand musical finale this year. Instead, a touching remembrance of times and Christmases past from Ken Watkins.
This year we'll be spending Christmas on our own, just my wife and me. It's happened before in 2020 when COVID meant Christmas Day contact with the family was an online activity only. Prior to that, and since, Christmas has always meant either visiting the family or having them descend on us. That happened last year when our daughter and son-in-law visited Barry. But this year, Sue and Nathan will be spending the festive season with his parents in Portugal. If I'm really honest, neither Judy nor I have any complaints. Apart from our invite from neighbours to join them and others on Christmas Day morning, and a Boxing Day visit to a housebound friend, it means we'll be able to do exactly what we wish to do. If the weather's good, a walk, almost certainly down at Barry Island, where dogs are now allowed on the sand, having been banned for the summer. We no longer have a dog, but watching other people's pets enjoying their freedom is really uplifting. Our daughter and son-in-law are repeating the pattern that characterised our lives for many years. The occasional Christmas apart, we would usually have parents visit us, largely because my job involved working on Boxing Day. Unless the weather ruled it out, on Boxing Day, as a sports writer, I would be reporting a football match, and sometimes two, one in the morning and the second after lunch. But it was lovely, when our children were very young, to have grandparents staying with us, albeit just for a few days. While Judy and I took care of the catering, the rest of the family could enjoy each other's company. And my dad could escape, if he wanted to, by coming to a football match with me on Boxing Day. One year, when I was reporting on Southport FC, then in the Football League, he came with me, and while I was in my usual spot in the press box, he was invited into the boardroom and watched the game from the director's box, which certainly made it a Christmas to remember for him. For a brief spell in the mid-80s, we lived in Banbury, halfway between two sets of parents, mine in Coventry, Judy's just south of Oxford, both about an hour's drive away. That meant, unless they were coming to stay with us, we could visit one set on Christmas Day and the other on Boxing Day or New Year's Day. Much easier all round. It's certainly a truism that Christmas can be a wonderful time for children. I can't remember a bad Christmas when I was growing up in Coventry. An aunt, uncle and cousins lived next door, and another aunt and uncle lived in the next street. And on Christmas Day, after lunch, we would all gather in one of the houses to enjoy a very light tea and cake and play various games. And we'd do it again, Boxing Day, if Coventry City were away. I know that at Christmas, growing up, there were always plenty of presents, the usual comic albums and a selection box among them. But the only one that really sticks in my mind was 1957 when, after a spell in hospital, I came home for Christmas. And on Christmas Day morning, there was a Dansett record player and a 78 RPM record, Teddy Bear by Elvis Presley, not at the foot of the bed, but on the table downstairs. So I guess it didn't come down the chimney. Together with my cousins Dave and Jill, I spent much of Christmas Day playing it over and over and over. We didn't quite wear the record out, but I think we came pretty close. But for me, more recently, the best aspects of Christmas came when we lived in Suffolk, in Alfeton. Each year, early in December, there would be lights on a tree on the village green. We'd sing a couple of carols, hear a few words from the vicar, and someone would read out the names of fondly remembered loved ones no longer with us. And after that, it was back to the church or one of the houses nearby for mince pies and mulled wine. A lovely evening when most of the people in that little village gathered together. And 2 weeks later, the carol service in the candle-lit village church and more mince pies and mulled wine. The community in harmony at Christmas. Memories I'll always cherish.
Thank you, Ken Watkins. What a lovely reflective piece to leave us with. The joy of a record player. Winter walks on a beach, connecting with friends, family and neighbours. I especially enjoyed the image of your dad being entertained in the director's box while you worked. The generosity of spirit at Christmas. Well, there we are. Thank you to everyone involved in not only this edition of the magazine, guest Rachel Taylor, our contributors, and technician Dave Sullivan, but also to all the volunteers, committee and trustees who make it possible. Merry Christmas, and We hope you'll join us again in the new year.
Merry Christmas!